Exodus 2. Exodus chapter 2, the title today is A False Sense of Security. And what we want to talk about a little bit is fear. And fear can taint our perception of reality. And most of you probably know that already. You may have never thought of it that way, but fear can change the way we see things. So can the denial of fear. And so when we're fearful, but yet we deny the fear as if nothing is wrong, that certainly can change our perception of things as well. And so it is that we do these type of things in order to cover other things up. I love the little picture on the screen this morning. I bet some of you played with these things as kids, right? You go into the grocery store or somewhere and you're begging your parents or someone, whoever you're with, to buy you this disguise. And that's what we think of sometimes when we try to cover things up. We put on these little glasses and this little fake mustache, and we think that nobody will know who we are. And so in life, we try to use certain tactics coupled with denials, which often lead to this false sense of security, thinking that no one will really know who we are or what we've done. And so by creating a cover, taking steps to create this cover, we are really oftentimes are trying to cover our sins. We're trying to cover our shortcomings. We're trying to cover other things up that bother us, that make us uncomfortable. And when we do so, we also sometimes attempt to supersede the will of God. That's kind of what the story is today that Kelly was telling. How that Moses was, in essence, trying to take some things into his own hands before it was time because he wanted a change. He saw a change needed to take place. And what we're actually doing is we're doing nothing more than lying to others and lying to ourselves. And so Kelly had it right when she was telling the kids this morning that what they were actually doing was, or what those type of actions are, was actually a lie. Some of the worst lies are the ones that we tell to ourselves. Let's review just a little bit. As we began in the book of Exodus, we talked first about Joseph, how that Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers because they were jealous. Joseph also had a problem with being a little cocky and running his mouth. And so they sell him into slavery, and he, through the providence of God, rises to second in command in Egypt. He's highly respected. A man of great power. But yet, after 400 plus years, what happens? The power shifts. There's a new pharaoh. There's a new group leading Egypt. And it's not that they didn't know about Joseph, that this new pharaoh chose not to respect Joseph or the Hebrews. And so what they sought to do, or what the new pharaoh sought to do, was to enslave them, to take them and use them for his goals, trying to accomplish his legacy, if you will. And so with that, what happens? Pharaoh then begins to see that these people could be a threat to him, or he perceives it to be a threat, not that they are a threat, but that he perceives them to be a threat. And the more he burdens them, the more they prosper, the more they grow. And then what does he do? He takes it to a whole nother level. Instead of burdening them physically, he burdens their hearts by commanding that all the male children be put to death. And hence we have the beginning of Moses, how that his mother sees that he is a good child, a goodly child, a godly child. And she builds this ark, places him in the Nile, hoping, praying, trusting that God will intervene. Pharaoh's daughter is by the Nile on this day. She hears the child crying and the ark is open, and she looks at him and she takes him in her hands, and her heart is stirred, and she knows exactly what's going on. This is one of the Hebrew children that has been ordered to be killed, but she can't put him to death. So then Moses' mother is called to nurse this child until he's old enough to come into Pharaoh's home and be raised by Pharaoh's daughter. I also want to remind you that the book of Exodus is a microcosm of the redemption story running from Genesis to Revelation. That's the entire theme of the Bible, redemption. And we see it in little parts all along the way, but the book of Exodus is just a magnificent book revealing the redemption story. And today I hope we'll see how Moses, as a young man, knowing his true identity and wanting to do well, took matters into his own hands and made an error in judgment. He then literally thought he could cover a sin. He literally thought he could put a disguise on it and that no one would know, no one would recognize. And then he realized his mistake, believing that he could cover it up, thinking no one else would know. It was a fatal flaw, in a sense. It was a fatal flaw in his reasoning. So that's our review. That catches everyone up to speed. And here's where we begin this morning. Number one, there's no real security in our secrets because someone always knows more than we think they do. People always know more than we think they do. They know more than we want them to know. Excuse me. Very few are truly masters of disguise. We might think that we are. We like to think that we are. As children, we think that we're great at it. Who was it that, which kid said that they hid stuff under their bed? Where's the parent? You're the one. I thought it was Hope. But they soon realize that mama's going to find it, or somebody's going to find it. We're going to be found out. I saw this here in the school a week or two ago. And most of us are like those small children like I saw a few weeks ago where, I don't know who it was. It was a mother that was picking up another child and they had a small one. And they were talking with someone else and the child put their hands over their eyes. Remember doing this with your children, if you have children or your grandchildren, put their hands over their eyes, and then you go, where's Joshua? Where's Joshua? And Joshua thinks that he has disappeared, right? And we laugh because it's so cute. It is cute when you're small. It's not so cute when you're an adult. Thinking that you can cover your eyes and somehow God doesn't see you, or that others don't see you. There's very little hidden in our world. Even on the web, sometimes we think that we're hidden and we're not. That little IP address gives you away, or at least your home away, or your location away. If someone really wants to know something about you, you're all over social media, no matter what kind of security settings you might have. All it takes is getting onto another friend's page, and if you like something or you reposted something, then all they do is chase it down and they know things about you. Years ago, we had I was at this church in Wilmington, and they had never had a web page. I mean, you talk about the dark ages. We were in the dark ages there. And that was about 2000. And so we developed this web page, and I go back a year or so ago when I'm looking at stuff and updating some things, and I come across this page on me. This website has been taken down for years. There's a whole new website. But yet someone on the web took my bio and all these things that they found out about me, and there's a page. And I'm going, who did that? But evidently, most people have those kind of pages if you've ever put anything on the web. Do a search on your name. If you haven't already, most of you probably have if you get on the computer. You might be surprised at what you find and what people actually know about you. Type in your name, and that can also tell you where you've lived for the last umpteen years. How old you are. Very little is in secret anymore. That brings us to our first passage this morning. Exodus 2, 11 through 14. One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. Now notice, church, there's quite a jump in time here from when Moses was in that little ark in the Nile, and we're told that he is going to be nursed by his mother until he's weaned, and then we don't see anything of him until he's an adult. So we don't know exactly how much time has passed, but we know quite a few years have passed. We know that he's grown up in Pharaoh's home, in the palace. If you've ever watched the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, you'd think Moses grew up oblivious to his true identity, right? But he didn't. This passage gives us a completely different picture. He knew who he was. Now, again, what time in life he became aware, we're not sure. But I have a sense, as other commentators and other pastors and theologians have written, that growing up in Pharaoh's home, most people knew who he was. He may have been raised as an Egyptian, being educated in Pharaoh's home and in the schools and ways of thought. But he was a Hebrew, and he knew it. Look at that passage again. When Moses had grown up, he went out to his people, looked on their burdens, and notice in the next line, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He knew exactly who he was. And here now, being a member of Pharaoh's home, understanding who he is, he sees an Egyptian servant beating a Hebrew, and he kills him. It's like there's no thought to it. It's a reaction. I'm going to take care of this right now. But see, I think there was thought to it.
Let me ask you this question. If he's a member of Pharaoh's home, and he grew up in the palace, then why would he be afraid of retribution for killing an Egyptian servant? Why?
Here's the reason why. Because his act of rebellion and sedition, that's why.
See, Moses knew who he was, and he was acting as a Hebrew and not as a member of Pharaoh's home.
And so what he was saying to Pharaoh is, let's see, how could I put it in today's vernacular? Stick it. I don't want any part of you. And how do we know that he actually said that? How do we know that that's what Moses was really feeling? Because the writer of Hebrews in 11:24 says this, "By faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." He rejected his raising. He rejected his upbringing. He rejected his home. He rejected his adoptive mother. He rejected Pharaoh and the state of Egypt. Now also remember, the book here of Exodus is a microcosm of the redemption story. I said that to you a while ago. Meaning that we can see the story of Christ throughout this book. Also remember that Moses is a type of Christ. He's a deliverer. He's a prophet. He's a type of Savior pointing to the actual Savior, the real Savior. He's pointing, his life points to Jesus. So throughout the book, as we're going through, I've encouraged you to look for these Christ moments. And here's a Christ moment. There's a connection again. Look at verses 13 and 14a again. "He went out the next day. Behold," look, pay attention to. When you see that word, it should grab your attention. "Behold," take note of this. "Two Hebrews were struggling, and he said to the man in the wrong, 'Why do you strike your companion?'" And note the answer. "He answered, 'Who made you a prince and judge over us? According to the Midrash, which is a type of commentary on the Torah, it's a Jewish commentary, it's very old. The Hebrew here, the slave, is actually given a name. And his name is Dothan. And Dothan is the one who is rejecting Moses. Now I want you to look at that passage again. Look at it. "He answered, 'Who made you prince and judge over us?'" Not just me, but us. And who's the us? The Hebrew people. "Who made you king over us?" Here's that Jesus moment. John 19:15. "They cried out, 'Away with him, away with him, crucify him.' Pilate said to them, 'Shall I crucify your king?' The chief priests answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.'" The Hebrews, 1,500 years later, are crying out, "Who made you our king?" See, I think that's a pretty significant moment here. Because it would be significant if it happened just one time. But for
years in the wilderness, once they leave Egypt, the people continue to reject Moses. And by rejecting Moses, they are rejecting God. Isn't that kind of how we do today sometimes? Even as Christians, we're going along and life is okay. Then we hit this bumpy spot. And things aren't going so well right now. And we get a little agitated. We get a little angry. And maybe God is trying to do something in our lives. And we fight back. We rebel. And in a sense, we reject what He's doing. Yet He's very patient with us. Sometimes He gives us a little slap on the head. Get your act together. Come on. And then sometimes He just lets us kind of wallow in it for a little while. He gives us just enough rope to hang ourselves. The Hebrews would reject Moses many, many more times. Look back at the passage again. There's a belief here that what Moses was attempting to do was to bring this type of some sort of reform to Egypt. He was trying, in essence, to rescue his people from this great burden that's been placed upon them. He was trying to bring them freedom. Yet his efforts may not have been the right way of going about bringing this freedom. Again, this is another Christ connection, another Jesus moment. If that's truly Moses' desire is to set his people free, and I believe it is, the problem seems to be that he takes matters into his own hands under his own power. And so here's another question. Have you ever noticed that when we try to do extraordinary things under our own power, we fail extraordinarily? Let me say that again. The question is, have you ever noticed that when we try to do extraordinary things under our own power, we fail extraordinarily? I think that's what happens with Moses here. He went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And then in verse 12, he looked this way and that. And seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Moses had compassion for his people, the people who were being mistreated. Yet compassion isn't enough reason for taking the life of another. It doesn't justify murder. But hear me though, church. This doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to defend the defenseless. We do. And as Christians, we should be the first to intervene for those who are in need of rescue, who are in need of refuge. But how we go about it is important. It's extremely rare that such measures as the one Moses employed are to be used. Notice I said extremely rare. I would encourage you, every Christian should take the time to read this book by Eric Metaxas. And the book is called, it's about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The title is Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one of the Christians during World War II that stood up to Hitler and sought to have Hitler assassinated. While all other Christians and Christian leaders were laying down at the feet of Hitler,
Bonhoeffer stood up. It cost him his life. But there is a time for such things. But this wasn't the time for Moses to take such measures. It's a rare, rare thing. Notice the words there again. He looked. There in verse 12. He knew what he did was not only questionable or what he was getting ready to do. He knew it was wrong. It was a deliberate, a meditated thought. Because how many of you just react to something, and before you react to some injustice, you start looking around to see who's watching? You don't. You just react. Moses knew exactly what he was doing. And then to compound it and to prove that he knew what he was doing, for someone that is in the right, for someone that is really on the side of justice, they don't drag the body and bury it in the sand. When we find ourselves, and I hold on to this one, you ready? Because Nate is translating this into Spanish. Ready? When we find ourselves in a tizzy, I want to know how you translate tizzy there. When you find yourself in a jam, you know what? I have to admit something. This is a side note. I did that out of meanness because actually I thought Carlos was going to be translating today and I wanted to see him sweat. I love you, Carlos. I was just going to have a little fun with you. But when we find ourselves in a jam or in a tizzy, and we feel the need to hide or cover things up, then it's time that we do some self-examination. I know that first point was really long. These next two will be quick, I promise. Brings us to number two. Running from issues provides only temporary relief at best. That is concerning one's security. Man normally runs for one or two reasons. We normally run out of fear, or we run because we've done something wrong. Sometimes it's a combination of the two. But the real reason is it's out of fear or out of guilt for the wrong that we've done. Look at verse 15 here. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Again, Pharaoh most likely wasn't so upset about the death of an Egyptian national as he was upset with the rebellion and what Moses had begun, or what he was afraid of he was starting, this national rebellion. He was upset with what this death represented. He was upset with who committed this act. Again, no doubt Moses had been treated well in Pharaoh's home, being educated and fed and taken care of. And it's kind of a slap in the face if you think about it. Look at what I've done for you. I spared your life. I've given you these things. I've taken care of you. I've raised you as an Egyptian, as one of my own. And you reject me. While Moses felt the need and urgency to run as a young man, he truly would grow up and later return to stand his ground for his people, for those who really couldn't stand for themselves. And there's some lessons for us to learn just from this one little passage of Scripture. And Kelly kind of hit on it in her presentation in the children's message. First of all, God's call and purpose is rarely revoked because of sin. Now see, I'm telling you, I'm not saying that people aren't sometimes put on a shelf for a little while. They're taken out of ministry for a little while. But rarely is the call totally revoked. If a call and purpose that God has on your life and for your life is revoked because you sin, we might as well all pack it up today. I'm just curious. Let me take a poll. Are there any non-sinners here today? Not a one. Now, remember, we might be given some time. We might be put in time out by God, so to speak, to be restored, to regroup, to heal, and to grow before we're allowed back in the game or the ministry. But hopefully it doesn't take 40 years for that to take place. That brings us to our third and last point. Genuine security may begin with a learned sense of humility. A learned sense of humility. Humility can be a humbling thing. Actually, I got one smile out of that. I got two smiles out of that. Thank you so much. That was my best yogiism, Yogi Bear. I love one of the things that Yogi Bear said. He said, always go to other people's funerals, otherwise they won't go to yours. It'll come to you, I promise. Humility can be a long process, and for Moses, again, it was about 40 years in the making. But humility isn't always something that is learned in despair or trouble. And humility sometimes is just simply learned by a consistent walk with God over time. We just need to spend time with Him. Our last passage. Exodus 2:16 through 22. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled their troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian, his clothing must have given him away. An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man. That's important. He was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son and called his name Gershom. For he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." Quickly. Moses again shows his true character here. Why was it that Moses killed the Egyptian? Because he was burdened for his people. He wanted to bring them freedom. And so in his true character, in his call and in his purpose, he really did want to do the right thing. And so here we see an act of chivalry. And he intercedes, he intervenes on the behalf of others who are defenseless. Here the shepherds come and they chase these women away. And Moses says, "Wait a second.
I can sit here by the well and do nothing, or I can stand up and do something. Here's another Jesus moment. There's a couple of them. He's sitting by the well, and here comes this woman or these women, and he chooses to interact with them. Sound like anybody you know? He didn't have to, but he chose to. And then not only that, here's another Jesus moment. As he intervenes because they are being treated unjustly, he intervenes on their behalf like Jesus did when the Pharisees, the scribes and the Pharisees drag this woman to him and they say, "Rabbi, this woman's been caught in an act of adultery," John chapter 8. "The law says we're to stone her." Jesus could have said, "You know what? They caught you. You're guilty. Nothing I can do." But there was more to the story, and Jesus intervened. Notice he stooped down and he started writing something in the sand. We don't know what he wrote. There's lots of guesses. But one by one, they started to disappear, and she was left before him. And he says, "Is there no one to accuse you? No one. Then go and sin no more." There are lots of little Jesus moments in this. For Moses, it was the beginning of a new learning process. He had learned the ways of the Egyptians. He knew his identity. But now he needed to spend some time with God in another land, in another place, at another time. And it was going to be a humbling experience. Because remember, this is a man that was raised in luxury. And now he's living in the desert in a tent with his father-in-law and a bunch of women and some goats and sheep. His life has done a 180. There's some learning that needs to take place. But yet he seems to embrace it. Humility isn't always what we think it is. A friend of mine who was a graduate assistant at Liberty University when I was there, he was the assistant strength coach. He went on to become the head strength coach. He was the strength coach for the Seattle Seahawks. He's a world record holder in the bench press. He bench pressed 804 pounds. He's a massive man. But he's more a massive servant for Christ. He did an interview not long ago, and I thought one of the things that he said about humility was so telling and so true. This is what Bill Gillespie said. Is it there? I hope you can see that. But in his interview, this is what he said to the interviewer. "Contrary to what most of us think about being humble, so many times God does something great in our lives and people expect us to put our heads down and say, if you knew Bill, you could hear him say, 'Aw, shucks,' because he's a good old country boy. I learned if God is doing something in your life and you don't want to talk about it, then you think you are actually the one who did it. But if God is doing something, I want to shout it from the hilltops. I want to tell people what God is doing in my life. If God healed me from a tragic illness or a horrific car accident, I'd be shouting praises to God for what He did in my life." See, I think that puts a whole new light on what we believe humility is. For some of us, we really struggle with humility, but for different reasons. Some are proud. Some just wonder, could God love me enough to do anything in my life that's great anyway? God took a man who was raised with the greatest things that the world had to offer at the time, put him in one of the lowest places, yet he seemed to thrive in such an environment. As we close this morning, I'm going to dismiss David and the gentlemen who are being baptized this morning. And as they get ready, I want to just simply challenge you. I want to challenge you to examine your life, first of all. Where are you at with God right now? Where's your walk at? Are you walking closely with Him? Are you walking in humility? Or are there some things that you're trying to cover up? Or are there some things in your life that you're trying to do in your own power, in your own will? Let's take a moment. Let's just talk to God, shall we? You don't have to stand. Belinda's not going to come. Chambra's not going to come. They'll come in a moment. They'll close us out with our offering and benediction and our closing song. But right now, right where you sit, will you bow your heads, please?